Okay, Nehemiah 7. The first five verses, you see this is a genealogy, and it's important to those who did it. It's given by the Holy Spirit here. It shows us the people and how it was ordered. It has a purpose for that. It doesn't have as much impact to us because it's a list, but we see evidence of the Lord's work here and their care, and we'll note it to that end. But I just want to read the first five verses, Nehemiah 7. Then it was when the wall was built and I had hung the doors, when the gatekeepers, the singers, and the Levites had been appointed, that I gave the charge of Jerusalem to my brother Hanani and Hananiah, the leader of the citadel, for he was a faithful man and feared God more than many. And I said to them, do not let the gates of Jerusalem be opened until the sun is hot. And while they stand guard, let them shut the doors and bar them, and appoint guards from among the inhabitants of Jerusalem, one at his watch station and another in front of his own house. Now the city was large and spacious, but the people in it were few, and the houses were not built. Then my God put it into my heart to gather the nobles, the rulers, and the people, that they might be registered by genealogy. And I found a register of the genealogy of those who had come up in the first return and found written in it. And then there's all those names there. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you so far from the time of the blessing of this chapter that in that day that important work was accomplished. And as it was accomplished, there was honor to you and help to your people and a raising of your people. And Lord, even though later on it was to fall again and this is the way of men, but Lord, at that time, clearly an evident blessing from you. And it's a warning to us and an encouragement to us for Lord, what they had, they didn't keep forever. And subsequent generations, or even that generation, were not always careful with it. But Lord, it is a work that you did, and we give you praise for it. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, we talked about Sunday that Christianity is a practical religion. In the eyes of God, to have an acceptable religion, it has to be practical. Doesn't mean if you practice a religion that it's acceptable, but that if you don't practice the right religion, it is not acceptable to God. Now, there are plenty of religions and people practice them, but unless it's of God, it is not honorable. So the truth should be practiced. Not just theory we have, doctrines we have, but theology is practical. People talk about theology. We don't want to talk about theology. Theology is just not interesting to me. That's stuff that, you know, even if I'm a Christian, I don't have to study theology. Well, theology is the study of God. And we have already too much ignorance among professing believers that they would justify that by saying they should not study about God or study theology. And so there's, because, but what you will see is if a person doesn't want to study theology, they also don't want to practice. So it's not like people are saying, oh, I just want to practice my religion. I don't care about theology. Well, you don't usually find that together. Whereas a person says, I don't want theology, I just want to live for Christ. And if you live for Christ, you want to know about theology. If you get theology, you want to live for Christ. So it works out the same. They're one after the other. You lay the foundation like Ephesians. In Ephesians, the first three chapters lays the foundation. The last three chapters talks about the outworking of that foundation. So that's the way the Bible speaks. Look at James chapter 1. There's a great example of it, of what is a proper religious practice. Verse 26 of James 1. If anyone among you thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is useless. Now, that says that you could have even the right religion, but nullify it because you don't practice it. Now, it doesn't nullify the religion, because the religion is absolute. It's expression of what God has told us to do. That doesn't change. But you can nullify it by not practicing it, or by a loose tongue in this case. Here's a person who does not speak properly. We know, if we look in the scriptures, there's various sins of the tongue. This just says does not bridle his tongue. It means control the tongue. So you don't bridle your tongue. You're gossiping, you're lying, you're backbiting, you're, you know, those types of things. Slander, blasphemy. And people often say, well, I didn't think before I spoke. And they kind of wave it off like, forget it, I wasn't thinking. Well, if you don't bridle your tongue, it means you can't tame it. Because James says you can't tame the tongue. It's an unruly evil. It's full of all kinds of possibilities for disaster. Because people don't think. I heard of a girl, I guess a young girl, dating a guy for a week and decided to show her love for him. She got a tattoo of his face on her arm. After a week. And he gave her money for it, apparently. Not for that, but for something else. So she shows up and says, look. And he broke up with her. 1 week. You have to be able to control yourself. And your tongue is one thing that is so easily let out of control. And James talks about it here in his epistle in chapter 3. But you see, that's the practice. If you can't control and direct your tongue in practice, not just words, but proper words, then your religion is useless. Verse 27, pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this. And notice, it's practice. To visit orphans and widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. So to be a truly religious person is not a mechanical thing. It's not a ritualistic thing. And yet how many people, the expression of their religion is in ritual. Going to church, singing a song, going home, giving an offering, or in other churches, making certain signs, making certain, you know, bowing here and there, and the Muslims praying five times a day in a certain fashion, facing Mecca, and it's just all ritual. The Mass in the Catholic Church, many Baptists, they live in just a ritual. And they call themselves a Baptist. Well, how are you a Baptist, we might say? Well, I joined the church when I was a kid. And you know, there's a lot of people, and you know a lot of them probably, who were Baptists back when they were kids. And then as soon as they got older, what happened? They're still Baptists now. They'll tell you that. They're still Baptist. Well, they just don't go to church anymore. They don't learn to study the Bible anymore. They don't pray that so much anymore. They're not faithful about, they don't serve the Lord. They don't feel, I mean, they give you a whole list of all the things they don't do, but still Baptist. Because they, it's like you, you know, it's like you were anointed as a Baptist and it meant nothing after that. It's be like an employer hiring an employee, and all the employee did was sit and do nothing. Well, I'm an employee here. Well, not unless you work, you're not. And so what James says here, and he goes on into this with faith and works in chapter 2, is that if you have true faith, then it has an outworking. Faith without works is dead, he'll say later. But if you want to have pure and undefiled religion, how do you judge it? Well, today you judge it by a person saying, oh yeah, I'm a Christian. I'm a Baptist. I'm a church member. I'm a God-fearing person. I've read the Bible. Whatever. But when James evaluates what pure and undefiled religion before God is, it is a practice. It does not dismiss the theory. It does not dismiss the foundation. By no means does it do that. But it's just merely saying, I know you're right, and I know your foundation is right when your actions are right. The outworking. Of course, there are people today who say there's no way you could even say that there's an outworking of salvation because that brings works into it. There are some people who are so off on this that they believe salvation by grace means no guarantee ever that you will be obedient in works and in practice. It's all theory. And I just think it's a crazy thing, but a lot of people who are famous Christians believe things like that. Oh, it's preferable if you would be obedient. It's preferable if you would serve. It's preferable if you'd be, exercising your spiritual gifts and eager to love in an active way. But, it's just not required. We hope someday you will. And to keep oneself unspotted from the world, today the thought is you're just like the world. You just say you're a Christian and like the world. And so all of that is folly, according to James. So it's a practice. So what do you do when you build walls in a city? What do you do when you spend 52 days building after all that preparation and travel? We saw last time it took 52 days to complete the walls. A big work. It was not that they built them from scratch. They were broken down. They needed to be repaired. The gates hung again. But it says there, Nehemiah says it was finished in 52 days. So in 52 days, it is done. I visited my sister's Christmas, and she has, since I've been there, they built a nice deck covered with a tin roof and very spacious. And you know what they had on that deck? Now, you bear with me, you're going to think this is strange. They had chairs and seating on that deck. I'm thinking, isn't it enough to build a nice deck, a wood deck, nice boards? Isn't it enough to have those banisters up? Are you going to use it too? What is this concept? They had a grill out there. Do they really intend to grill out on their deck? It's offensive, isn't it? It's an assault on salvation by grace, right? They're going to use it. What's the world coming to? Yet if you said to people, well, now that you're a Christian, what kind of Christian works will you do? What? I mean, what kind of service will you want? I'm not going to be a pastor. I'm not going to be a Sunday school teacher. I'm a Christian. That's all I care to be. People have a wrong idea of service, of course, because they think it's something showy, but you know, if you love the Lord, you want to serve the Lord, and if you're a Christian, you want to practice it. So what many Baptists get excited about is a building program. I've heard, you know, some of my friends, you know, their church was at its healthiest place when there was a building program. Because a building, you know, what we had this to build. And it's an exciting time. Nothing wrong with that. We're not going to shame excitement. The Lord provided us this and workers and materials, and it was paid off very quickly, and that's a great blessing. And there's nothing wrong with that. But the problem, of course, is people and Baptists are certainly guilty, but I think it's not just Baptists, are excited about building a structure. But when the structure is done, they are done. When the structure is over, they're not interested anymore. And there's no excitement in the Christian life. There's no excitement in Christian service. There's no excitement in spiritual building. And the lack of devotion to building the church by the grace of God filling your part, that doesn't excite people. And if you want to cause a revival of interest in the church, you know what you got to do? You got to start another building project. Then people will be interested again. And that's great to be interested in when we do that. But what do you do when you build it? What are you putting seats in this church for? Isn't it enough that it's built? Isn't it enough we've got a building here? We're going to have to come here? We're going to have to attend? We're going to have to serve here? What is that? We're going to have to practice church now that we build a building? Oh, such a concept. Well, yeah, that's what we're supposed to do. What were they doing in Jerusalem? It's the same with Ezra. When he chronicles that first coming. And any of the subsequent things that were happened there. Is that there's something to do with it. There is an active thing to do once you do it. Got you a car? Got you a new car? Oh, I'm never going to drive that car. I don't want to ever drive it because I just don't want to mess it up. Cindy told me of her, I think it was her grandparents, who had that really thick plastic on their furniture. And I hope none of you have that because I'm talking about it now. You know, it makes a lot of noise when you sit down on it. And I bet in the wintertime, you better watch out what you're wearing when you get on that thing. But I've had clients that for computer stuff, and they don't ever want to pull off that thin strip of plastic that, you know, that shrink wrap, not plastic, I guess it's some form of that. They don't take that off because it's, you know, I mean, that's fine. And I say, I won't pull it off. But it's there to protect it until it is used. And like a couch, I never like to get on those couches that you couldn't hear while you were laying down on it. Like it was screaming at you. We're protecting it, and I don't know that it would ever decay in any way with that plastic around it. But you want it to be livable. So what we see in Nehemiah 7, and what we're going to see, you know, if you just look ahead, you see that in Ezra and in Nehemiah, there is a spiritual outworking to a physical building. When you build, Then, you know, you've got the return and the temple, and there is the great blessing of that the temple has been made, it's been restored, and then with Ezra, who comes up, you know, into this time, you start dealing with things that have to be corrected. So that's what's going on, and that is very logical. And it's logical in every other area of life. If a hunter gets a gun, what does that hunter want to do with that gun as fast as possible? Well, we got to go shoot it. We got to shoot it. How long have you men had a gun without shooting it? I mean, my dad has a gun he's never shot, but it's kind of for that purpose. There are collectibles. But if you get a gun to use, the words that you're thinking about is use. I'm going to use it. The first chance I get, I'm going out. Any gun I've ever gotten, it doesn't last long in a new mint condition. I'm going to get some gunpowder on it and all of that. It's going to have to be fired. So here they're going to make the building. What does he do? Look what he's doing here in chapter 7. It was when the wall was built and I had hung the doors, when the gatekeepers, the singers, and the Levites had been appointed. Now, wait a minute. This sounds like life. It sounds like they're going to start using the city to accomplish what the city should accomplish, to house life and the worship of God with the temple there. It's not going to be a monument. It's going to be a living, breathing city. So he gets basic things in place. The doors were hung, the wall finished. But now he's got gatekeepers and singers and Levites. We're talking about the building of the spiritual life. Because why did the city fall? Because the spiritual life was bankrupt in it. They would not obey. They turned away from the Lord. Now we're hearing in 2 Chronicles how the Lord sent prophets rising up early and sing them, but they would not listen. The hardness of their heart was such that the city's destruction was assured, and now the city is restored. Look at it. The city is restored. And so the first thing every time that happens is what we tried to do here and have done, although not all received it, is that you build up the spiritual life. It's not that you wait until the end to do that, but when it's done, you're not building anymore on the building, but you never stop building in the spirit. You never stop building your spiritual maturity. That's why you're building the building in the first place. You've got the city to take care of. And of course, this is a physical city and a physical people, a national people of God. But the temple was there. The worship of God was there. There were homes there. There were people that lived there. Jerusalem was the capital. It was the identity of the nation. If Jerusalem was there, then the people had a pride in their nation. Without Jerusalem there, their capital was overrun. And they had no dignity and placement among the nations. And we saw that in chapter 1 where the people were so distressed because the walls were broken down. He sets up all of that. Leadership, verse 2, he gave the charge of Jerusalem to my brother Hanani. Hanani, I assume, is the same one we saw in chapter 1, who came and reported the first time. And Hanani, the leader of the citadel. The citadel was like a fortress next to the temple to protect the temple. So you're putting in people who are faithful. It says of Hanani that he was faithful, a faithful man, and feared God more than many. Notice, being faithful and fearing God gave him the qualification to do what? Be the leader of the citadel. So you look for someone who has character, they are practicing, and then you bring them onto that job. Because it is just, it's so expected that a person who has the theory would practice it. Now, we all went to school, and we all know what it means to have sat in classes studying things we to this day don't know why. And we would ask, and my good friend of mine, he just recently died last year, heart attack, I guess, in my class, and a good friend, he would ask the teacher, what is this for? This was algebra and geometry. What is this for? And the teacher would say, you need to know this for college. Well, of course, that begs the question, what about, do we need it for after college? But she never would answer. It was like theory. One of the hardest things and the hardest learning to do is learning that has no application. And there is an application to geometry, and there is an application to algebra, and there's a calculation to the higher maths. And if we can be brought in on that in a practical way, the learning would be better. The teaching would be better. We need to be ready to tell people, if we're teaching them some skill, that when we tell them how to do this and they say, what's that for, that we can say what it's for. But if it's impractical, it's akin to being useless. So what are we going to use the city for? Well, we're going to use it for what it's supposed to be for. It's supposed to be for the Lord. It's supposed to be to protect his people, give them a safety and a security in the city, to promote the worship of God. That's what we're going to do with it. Perfect. That's exactly what it's for. You know, a city, Orangeburg or any place, usually the founders of a city have a very high expectation and a goal for a city. They expect it to be a nice place to live. Businesses can thrive there, on and on. And they don't expect the things to happen that happen later. Do you think our founding fathers expected that one day, or hoped that one day, the Supreme Court would rule, as they have this past year, to sanction same-sex unions? Do you think George Washington, all these guys, oh, I just hope someday that two men can come together just like a man and a woman do today. And I hope, and Thomas Jefferson says, I hope one day, and we're writing this Constitution for this purpose, I hope one day that a pregnant woman can go in and at any stage of her pregnancy have that baby chopped up and pulled out of her anytime she wants to. I just hope that happens. And let's write this Constitution to make sure it happens. Nobody said that. And yet, the application today is totally wrong from what the original intent was. There's a goal. And we have a goal for this church. We have a goal that it be a place of worship and learning and fellowship, and that we be equipped. What does the Bible say? Equipping the saints for the work of the ministry. What? Equipping the saints for the work of the ministry. That is the biblical description of what a church does. It's a pillar and support of the truth. And on the basis of the truth, you live out Christianity in this world. There are churches that exist for no other purpose than to foment disdain and anger and hate for whatever. the country, certain races. They have no teaching. There's no foundation. There's no fundamental grounds. It's just whatever they want. The church in Greenville is well known, get a lot of press attention for being the church, the Southern Baptist Church, I guess, that is all for gay marriage. Come on. Well, that's an outworking. And we're to have an outworking. It's just supposed to be according to the truth. So when they come together with this city, the point is to take care with it. When Paul wrote to Timothy in 1 Timothy 3:5, I think it is, he said that a man who is in charge of the church has to, you know, take care of his family, because if he can't take care of his family, how can he take care of the house of God? So you see, just indirectly there, he says, this is what we're to do. We're to take care of it. We're to be gentle with it. We're to be protective of it. We're to make it practical. We're to make it useful. But we're to do so in such a way that it fulfills its design. We take care with it. I mentioned the man with a gun earlier, gets a new gun, takes it out. You know, the most likely time for a gun to be cleaned properly is after it's shot the first time. Because the man says, I got to take my baby home and clean it up. I got it dirty. I mean, 5-10 years, he might shoot it 4 months and not clean it. but, you know, he starts off and he wants to make sure that it goes as long and with as much care and love as you can give a implement such as that. The church and the work of God should be even more cared for. We should be more in care of the things of God than anything else. And when the children of Israel forsook care for God, they forsook the care of the nation, because that's what brought them to destruction. They didn't care anymore. And verse 3, he gets these gatekeepers and gets the leaders, and he says, do not let the gates of Jerusalem be open till the sun is hot. And while they stand guard, let them shut the doors and bar them. Now, that is a very practical prescription for caring of the city. Most of the times, the city gates will be open very early. I don't know if there was an exact time, but, you know, early in the morning, you would go out there, and the first thing you do is you open up the gates. But because the enemies were around, and Nehemiah had been fighting them all that time, he gives instructions that they not be open till the sun is hot. That means it's up in the sky a ways. It's not low where it's not giving much heat yet. It's high where it's giving the full sunlight. And then he says, after that amount of time, then open the gates and keep a close guard. When they close them and bar them, watch. And when they close them, make sure you make them secure. Lock the doors. There was none of this thing, well, we'll just trust the Lord, leave the gates open. That's testing God. Why have the walls in the first place if you're not going to close them up? There's no more security with that. So lock the gates, watch them, make sure when they're closed, someone's guarding them. Make sure they're guarded at night. Appoint the guards from among the inhabitants of Jerusalem, one in his watch station, another in front of his own house, that they keep watch over the city. Why? Well, verse 4 says the city was large and spacious, but the people in it were few, and the houses were not rebuilt. There was still so much empty in the city. It did not justify non-attention. It was it just cried out for a greater care. And you could argue, I think, that a work that's small, like most, I guess, churches are, and ours certainly is, demands more care, not less. Although I understand when you got a big church, you got more that causes you concern and care. But you know, you got more people taking care of this and that. Maybe, you know, I've never had that situation. But I just think overall, universally, we care about the things of God. We take care of them. We're faithful to them, not a building. You notice if people just care about the building, when the building's done, you're done. But to care about the things of God, they took very good care. And Nehemiah is exemplary on this. And that's why all those names are mentioned. All that is also a chronicling to know who can do what and who can't do certain things and who the priests are and who the workers are. And we talked about that in Ezra. He's got just about the same list. The point being that you took care to do it right from the very start. You took a list. You made sure who could do what they could do and put them in the right spot, because the people then fill the city. Here's the church. Here's the steeple. Open the door and see all the people. That's not a biblical picture of the church. The church is the people. So the people meet in the church. If there's no people, there's no church. There's a building. So this is when the gates are done, when the wall is finished, everything's locked up, life then is applied in that city with care. I was told, I'm sure as you probably were as a child, when you got something, we got to a certain age where we were told, okay, now you have to take care of this. Wasn't that awful? You have to take care of this. Because, you know, kids, younger kids, toys have to be made in such a way that they can almost strike a nuclear bomb on them and they'll still survive, because they don't take care of them. They don't watch where they are. They lose them. One time the plumber found, I think I told you, found a little toy soldier in our toilet. I wonder how that got there. My theory is he just jumped in. But you know, I'm sure I put it in there, and he found me out. Thing got clogged up, and so here comes the plumber, and oops, there's that toy soldier. Well, you know, you take care of things that are valuable, and this is what Nehemiah's doing here. Any thoughts or comments you have?